be seated. Our final case for today is case number 72098, Rodriguez v. G.S. DePons, LLC. Mr. Eccles for the appellant, Mr. Eisenberg for the respondent. Mr. Eccles, would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Please.
All right, I'll keep it on the clock for you. We're ready to go.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Micah Eccles for appellant Enrique Rodriguez. This is a case in which the district court abused its discretion in refusing to grant Rodriguez a 60B motion. The relief we're seeking from this court is to set aside the dismissal and the 15 motions in limine which were granted. So the district court's order has a number of issues right in the order. First off, I guess I should state the standard review. Standard review is abuse of discretion. We've cited the AA Primo Builders case that says no legal error, or no deference is given to legal error. And the Mosley versus district court case is what we've cited for the notion that really when construing the reasonableness in Rule 60B, that's a de novo standard. What we're basically asking the court to do is apply a reasonableness standard to Mr. Rodriguez for a similarly situated person, not somebody who's unlike him. And that's where the district court primarily erred. So in the district court's order, it identifies the Union Petrochemical case, a case very unlike Mr. Rodriguez. And it held him to that higher standard in refusing to grant the 60B motion. The 60B motion was filed about a week shy of the six-month deadline. So we're not here to talk about the 6 months. We're really here to talk about the reasonableness. In Union Petrochemical, the corporate defendant in that case was counsel. In this case, Rodriguez was not at the time he had the case dismissed. In Petrochemical, it was a mere answer to a complaint for which there had been several extensions granted by the plaintiff. Here we have a complex case that at the time of the dismissal had been ongoing for about 10 years. Not an easy case for new counsel to just jump in and understand, unlike the filing of an answer to a complaint. In the 60B motion, there were two declarations attached, one from Mr. Rodriguez, one from his caretaker, Maria Perez. He lives out of state. He was pro per. That's also different from the petrochemical case. Although petrochemical was in Texas, but the court noted in that case that they were incorporated in Nevada. So one thing I'll point out too, which is not in the order, is we didn't need a meritorious showing on the merits to set aside the dismissal. That requirement has been overruled by Epstein. So basically what we're asking the court to do is apply the reasonableness standard from Mr. Rodriguez's eyes, not from some hypothetical or even the very dissimilar corporate defendant in Union Petrochemical.
But isn't, I mean, a reasonable person standard is an objective standard. So how do we adopt that? It shouldn't necessarily be a changing thing. Help me with that.
So I think the way that the court has to analyze this, Your Honor, is to take a look at cases with similar facts and see how the analysis went in those different cases. The case that we found that I think is most similar to this case is the Harrison versus Thurston case, the Utah Court of Appeals case. In that case, it had been pending for 9 years at the time it was dismissed. The plaintiff in the case had lost her attorney, similar to Mr. Rodriguez in this case. I think he was disbarred in that case. And so what the court did in Harrison is it says, we're going to look at kind of the totality of the circumstances here, and we're going to weigh the different factors, which would be the Yoakum factors in Nevada. We're going to weigh the different factors, and we want to make sure that we're giving weight to all of the facts that were presented, not just a one-sided version, which is what we have in the district court's order here. And I'll go through those factors. So if we're looking at a reasonableness standard comparable to Mr. Rodriguez and his situation, a prompt application is going to be very different from somebody who's just sitting in an office and on a counsel case. The second factor, absence of an intent to delay, and really what this comes into, Your Honors, is the court never actually found that there was an intent to delay, or didn't consider all the facts on an intent to delay, focus on the intent.
Let's focus on what's the excusable neglect in this case? How that's what I need some help on.
Okay, and then I'll come back to this in a minute, Your Honor. So Mr. Rodriguez had his case reversed on appeal. That was 2014. His trial attorneys withdrew from the case. They didn't want to retry the case. He was without counsel for a while. He found Paul Pata, who took the case on, was committed to try the case. Then there was a change in, this is no longer a bench trial, but this is going to be a jury trial. And so what happened is, Pata was allowed to withdraw approximately 6 weeks before trial on a jury trial, and so Rodriguez is scrambling to try to find new counsel.
But wait, he withdrew in February. The trial was reset into May. So now we're more than 6 weeks. We're now months. I appreciate that's part of the chronology is where it was set. The court did move the trial date.
Correct. And I was talking about before the continuance. So what we have, there's almost 5 months of delay in the case just from department reassignments. That's in the middle of when Pata was counsel. Then we have another 2 months where defense counsel says, I'm going to be gone the entire month of December, and that was 2015, for a family emergency. I need to continue the trial. So the trial ended up getting continued about another 2 months. Now what's interesting, Your Honor, in the district court's order, it doesn't talk about any of that. It says Mr. Rodriguez was responsible for the entire delay of the case. It doesn't consider that at least 7 months or so of that was not even on, it wasn't even on his side of the case. So,
how so? I thought the defense only asked for, had a 60-day continuance at some point because there was a death in a family.
And the rest of
the continuances, as I understood, were attributable to Mr. Rodriguez or his legal team. Is that correct?
The 60 days is correct, Your Honor. And the rest of the actual trial continuances were Mr. Rodriguez. But what the district court doesn't take into account is the almost 5 months where the case was passed around to four different judges until it reached Judge Hardy. And that wasn't any doing because nobody filed any peremptory challenges from our side at all. So that can't be attributed to Mr. Rodriguez. And so what we have, Your Honor, is from the time the remitter issued from this court in the first appeal to the time that the 60B motion was filed, so that's a little bit less than 2 years. So we're only talking about a year and a half, and then if you take out the 7 months, we're not talking about the enormous amount of time that's outlined in the order. And so part of the problem with the way that the order is written, the way that everything was considered, the district court didn't consider all these extra factors.
When did Mr. Rodriguez, well, let's kind of fast forward to the motions in limine and the February 1st.
Okay.
When did the court, the first time I see in the record Mr. Rodriguez talking about anything external to these proceedings that impacted his ability to comply is in 2016 when you're litigating these motions.
I think the first time that I recall in the record, Your Honor, was at the motion in limine hearing where he appeared. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about that is some of the motions were served when he still had counsel, weren't served on his counsel. The order of withdrawal of Paul Pata didn't list out the dates and what needed to be done. The record does reflect that he was mailed a copy of the trial scheduling order. So Mr. Rodriguez shows up. He finds out about the hearing online. His position and his, I guess, testimony, I mean, he wasn't put under oath, but what he represented the court is that he had not received any of the 15 motions in limine. He starts to explain to the court what's going on. Hey, I'm having problems getting an attorney. I've got health issues. I need some more time. And at that hearing, Judge Hardy says, no, I'm not giving you any more time. All the motions in limine are granted. Judge Hardy really didn't let Mr. Rodriguez speak at that hearing very much. He wanted to explain more, but the judge just said, listen, you need to listen to me because I'm going to tell you what's going on. So that's kind of the first place where that happens, Your Honor. Based upon our argument that the reasonableness should have been somebody that was similarly situated, then it means all of the Yoakum factors are improperly analyzed. And then that would be kind of what we would consider a Wiley situation. That's the D.C. appellate court decision we cited that says if you have an improper rule that you're using or improper weighing of factors, then you've got to reverse on that basis. So the Stockling case is an interesting case because it's one of many that states that courts prefer to have cases tried on the merits. But it also states that in the context of the 60B motion, we don't have to satisfy all the factors. What it says is that it's a case-by-case basis, which in this case should have included all of the factors that Mr. Rodriguez had gone through.
But didn't the court consider what was presented to it? And consider all these factors? It's an abuse of discretion standard.
It is an abuse of discretion standard, Your Honor. I don't think that he considered everything. I mean, he read it, but if you read the order, it says the entire 10 years of the case is blamed on Mr. Rodriguez. And he says all of the trial continuances on the remand proceedings were all Mr. Rodriguez's fault. And that's just not true.
Well, you can't look at this case in a vacuum. The fact that the judge let Mr. Pata out, you know, that puts a lot of burden on a plaintiff trying to get an attorney on a contingent fee case. I mean, let's face it, what this is. I think the smart thing, I was a district court judge for 8 years, is what I would have done is say the motion will be granted as soon as he comes in with an attorney, because the trial was pending. So.
And that's what we would have preferred, Your Honor, and we probably wouldn't even be here today if that had happened. We cited EDCR 7.40, which does not allow withdrawal of counsel if it's going to move trial dates, for example. But it had the effect of doing that. And then Mr. Rodriguez is out of state. He's tasked with the opportunity or the burden to try to find somebody to try his case for him with 50,000 to 70,000 pages of documents. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you. Mr. Eisenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Robert Eisenberg with Lou Brandon on behalf of the respondents. In the Rule 60B motion, plaintiff's counsel at that time, Mr. Selleck, told the court there are certainly reasons to deny this motion. In his reply, he said a strong argument can be made to not grant relief. That was plaintiff's counsel said that. And in his reply, he said that a reversal of an order denying relief will not be likely. He also emphasized the fact that it's an abuse of discretion standard. We agree 100% with what Mr. Selleck told the court in those comments. It was completely discretionary. There were strong arguments in favor of denial of that motion, and a reversal is not going to be likely. I do want to clarify one thing that counsel said that was a mistake. To some extent, it's a little bit buried in the appendix, but he said that nobody filed any peremptory challenges from our side. That was not correct. The plaintiff filed his own proper person peremptory challenge against Judge Ellsworth, and that's in Volume 1, page 149 of the appendix. And that shows two things, really. It goes to the delay, because there was a delay because of that, when counsel says the case was being bounced around from one judge to another. That is true. Part of that was because of the peremptory challenge. But what it also shows, it goes to the factor, the Yoakum factor, about the plaintiff not being able to do things procedurally because he wasn't a lawyer. Did he have knowledge of procedural things? And somehow, he found out, when he wanted to challenge a judge, he found out how to do it. Filed it in proper person, paid the $450 filing fee, has a certificate of service attached to it, all of which he did in proper person. So it shows that when he wanted to, he had the ability to find out how to do something. Justice Stiglitz, you asked, what is the excusable neglect? And I think that's the key question in this whole appeal, really. What the main argument was in the district court on the motion was that he should be given another chance, that there should be, they didn't come out and use the word sympathy, but that's almost what they were asking for. Please have sympathy for him, give him another chance. They never really identified what was the excusable neglect. And they said, well, he didn't have lawyers for a long period of time. And he did have, say in his affidavit, that he had contacted several lawyers. Not during the 6 months after the dismissal, but before the dismissal. But if you don't have a lawyer, you still have to comply. And the judge warned him about that. The judge admonished him in court when Mr. Rodriguez was there. He said, sir, you need to comply with the rules. You need to comply with orders. And in fact, he said, we've got a hearing coming up on a motion to dismiss. You've got to do something. And so if he couldn't get a lawyer, and Justice Cherry, you said, well, maybe they should have, I'm paraphrasing what you said, but kind of held the motion to dismiss in abeyance until he got a lawyer. Well, he had already told the judge he had tried to get a lawyer and couldn't. So I don't think the judge was required to hold it in abeyance indefinitely for him. He was warned that, and in fact, the written orders from the court, the scheduling orders, specifically said, if you don't have a lawyer, you have to comply with legal requirements. And he did. And then he files the motion for 60B relief just days short of the six-month rule. And he argues, well, the six-month rule is what applies. Well, what the rule says is that it's within a reasonable time, not more than 6 months. So the 6 months is an absolute deadline, but the default rule is a reasonable time. And Judge Hardy found that it was not a reasonable time. It was not a prompt application under Rule 60B. Mr. Rodriguez never showed what he did during that 6 months' time to get counsel. His affidavit says, well, I tried to get counsel, but he had nothing specific at all. Did he contact the local bar association lawyer referral service? Did he contact the state bar lawyer referral service? You can't drive anywhere in Las Vegas without seeing billboards for lawyers. Did he contact those people? If so, how many? Did he look in the Yellow Pages for lawyers? Did he go online? Nothing specific about what he did during that six-month time frame. And it was well within Judge Hardy's discretion to determine that he did not file a prompt application under that rule. And the Union Petrochemical case, which counsel relies on here, says that one factor alone is sufficient. That if a judge finds it was not a prompt application under the rule, that the motion was filed within a reasonable time, that alone can be sufficient to justify denial of the motion. Counsel also said that he was suggesting that you apply a reasonableness standard from the plaintiff's perspective. And I would suggest that it should be a different perspective. It should be from the district judge's perspective. Because the standard is abuse of discretion. So did the district judge abuse his discretion in denying this motion? So what you need to do is look at it from his standpoint. What did he have in front of him? And was it an abuse of discretion for him to deny this motion? And we contend it was not. Also, I did want to mention that there were several arguments in the opening brief and the reply brief that we contended were not raised in the district court and were raised for the first time on appeal. Counsel has not argued those points today, but to the extent that you see them in the briefs, please keep in mind that they were not preserved. The disqualification of the judge, whether there should be an evidentiary hearing, whether the motion to dismiss should have been sent to the discovery commissioner, several issues like that were not raised in the district court. Additionally, I would point out that in the Rule 60B motion, it moved to set aside the order dismissing the case, but it did not argue that the order dismissing the case was legally infirm, that the judge abused his discretion by dismissing the case. That wasn't an issue. The issue on the 60B motion was whether that order should be set aside, not because it was legally erroneous, but because of some excusable neglect. And that's, it may seem like a subtle distinction, but it's an important distinction, because what the case law says is that a Rule 60B motion is not a substitute for an appeal. When this case was dismissed, the plaintiff had the right to file a notice of appeal. He didn't need a lawyer for that. It would have been helpful, but he didn't need one. If he had filed his appeal, his case would have gone into the court's proper person program. It might have been pro bono counsel appointed for him. Who knows? But instead, he didn't do that, and he filed his motion later on. So the case law is clear that you can't use a 60B motion as a substitute for a notice of appeal to raise attacks on all of the interlocutory orders that came before the dismissal or the dismissal itself. And in fact, in the reply in support of the 60B motion, Mr. Selleck admitted that the dismissal order was, to use his own words, certainly lawful. So he conceded that that order was lawful, and the only question was whether there was excusable neglect that may have led to that order. So he wasn't contending that the judge committed a legal error in granting that motion to dismiss. As far as Mr. Potta, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, but as far as his involvement, there seems to be some contention in the briefing that his withdrawal was erroneously granted. It's not entirely clear that that's what they're contending, but it seems to be. That was not raised in the 60B motion. Whether he should have given more notice to Mr. Rodriguez, whether he shouldn't have moved so close to the trial, anything like that, it just was not an issue that was raised in the 60B motion. It was mentioned in kind of a background fact, but the withdrawal itself, the order granting his withdrawal, was not challenged in the 60B motion.
I think that was brought up in the context of whether he received notice, correct? Whether he was properly noticed of dates, because Pata, I think it's Pata, I don't know, that Pata was his attorney at the time these notices were being sent. And although I think it's agreed they were sent to the plaintiff individually, that it was the attorney's responsibility to notify him of dates and deadlines. There was at least some conversation that that didn't happen.
He did argue that. Mm-hmm. What he called it was a technicality. That was a footnote in his mm-hmm. motion or his reply where he says, I basically concede this is really technical. But there was a short period of time, a few days, a week or so, when Mr. Pata was still counsel of record. But at the same time, notices were being sent to Mr. Rodriguez at his address in California. And what Mr. Selleck argued in the 60B motion was that those notices were a nullity, that they were as if they never occurred. He never cited any legal authority for that, didn't really press it at the hearing. It was kind of an imaginative argument that he came up with that. I'm unaware of any legal support. The fact is that even if Mr. Pata was still counsel of record at the time he was in the process of withdrawing, those notices were still sent to Mr. Rodriguez. And in fact, he showed up in court and he said, well, I wasn't getting the notices. And then he changed it a little bit. He said, well, I never signed for receipt of the notices. And the judge pointed out to him that you don't have to sign for receipt. And you obviously got notice because here you are in court. So really that whole issue, we think, respectively, was a red herring in the district court. And I actually have a little time left, but unless the court has any questions.
Anything further?
No, thank you, Mr. Eisenberg.
I think this is a first for me.
We'll remember that, Elizabeth. Next time he argues, we'll give him an extra 1 minute, 2 minutes and 20 seconds. Mr. Echo, you have a minute and 48 seconds. We'll round it off to 2 minutes. Give Mr. Echo 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. So when Judge Hardy dismissed this case, Mr. Rodriguez was standing in his courtroom, and Mr. Rodriguez believed that he had hired Jared Johnson to be there as counsel for him. Unfortunately, he didn't show up, but Judge Hardy still dismissed the case, and the case was really, it was described in the papers as a Rule 37 discovery sanction. Now, counsel has said that we didn't raise those issues in the 60B motion. That's correct. But the reason why we raised these in our briefs is I kind of looked at it like the Brunzell factors. When a district court makes a ruling on attorney's fees, they have to consider the Brunzell factors. The same is also true with the Young factors for discovery sanctions. If we look at the record and it's not in there, that's why we raised it.
But he didn't say it was a discovery sanction in his order. He specifically told Mr. Rodriguez, you've got to do something. This is on. You're not out all the way yet. You have to do something. And Mr. Rodriguez did nothing.
So in the order, it calls it a 16.1, 2.67, and a 2.68 sanction. But those are all discovery issues, Your Honor. And so we would say that they are Rule 37 because that's what they are.
Was there a citation to 2.20 for non-opposition to a motion?
In our brief, Your Honor?
No, the judges, in any of the judges' orders. Was that a consideration?
I think the judge did. I think he granted all the motions in limited based upon 2.20, Your Honor. In Mr. Rodriguez's affidavit, it says he was talking with 20 lawyers. One other issue is the prejudice issue, and this kind of goes back to the timing of everything. And the Harrison case talks about prejudice, but here there's no articulation of what that prejudice was. I see my time's up. Thank you,
Mr. Eisenberg.
Thank you.
Mr. Eisenberg, thank you for your fine argument to the finest appellate attorneys in our state, both of you, and you lived up to at least my expectations on this case.